welcome to this episode of Wrecking Ball, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I am your host, Kyle, and I'm not the only one loco for Lopez. I'm joined by my co-host, Tim. Tim, it's been a while. We've come back. Special one. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I missed talking about George Lopez, so I'm really excited for us to be back.
And I figured we had some time, I had a little break, we should get back and finally talk about George Lopez. So, get ready to it. Just everything been good? You've been doing well?
Yeah, just working a ton. I got nothing.
That doesn't sound right.
No, it's just a lot of work.
I was just hoping you had something more interesting, because, we got this all together so we could talk about the episode of George Lopez where Benny is still furious about her breakup with Randy, so she and Gina goes to Thirsty's, I'm guessing that's a bar, and they talk about how they think all men are bad, and the next day the factory is trashed. Everyone blames it on Benny because she is so mad at Randy. But did she do it? Because that would be a fun one to talk about, but unfortunately, Tim, we're not going to be able to talk about that today.
It's too bad. I waited so long.
I know. We can lie and say we've been playing this for 2 weeks but actually we have something really good and really exciting, something better than an episode of George Lopez. We're going to be talking to writer and behind the scenes friend of the show, Melissa Mazaros. God damn it. See? All right. We'll edit it. You won't even know. Yes. Well, thank you for joining us. I think we've brought you up on the show before. I think maybe, I don't know. But if anyone doesn't know, comics, getting people on sometimes to talk about stuff is difficult. So luckily there's an amazing PR person that we've been working with who represents some amazing guests that we've had, and she's been extremely helpful, extremely awesome, and actually stays on top of us about stuff, which is always great because I'm terrible at it. So I'm super excited to have her on to talk in general, but also talk about a new book she has coming out, Heavy Metal Headbang. And well, thanks for joining us, Melissa.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate you taking the time out of both your busy schedules to have a conversation about my Michigas.
I know, Tim was busy flipping over his laundry.
I swear, that's a thing.
It was a bubbler?
Sorry, yeah.
In the bubbler?
The bubbler?
He's taking it, yeah, on his way to the bubbler. He was flipping his laundry, parking his car. You had reached out to me about this, and I didn't know you were writing a book, which in itself is a feat in its own, but kind of the subject matter is pretty amazing. I guess we can get into it, but what is the book about, but how did you set out to kind of turn that into a book? Like, what was the first kind of thought or epiphany that you wanted to write a book, I guess?
Well, it actually started that because I had lost a lot of my memory. One of my therapists, because I had six, they told me to start keeping journals. And whenever I had a memory come up, which was very, very, very slow process, which was more audio than anything because all of my memories came through music, I started just writing on my phone a lot. I would sit on my front porch and be bothering Tim about something, usually work, sometimes work related. and I would be just typing memories down on my phone in Google Docs. And by the time I think I was 8 months in, I didn't realize how much I had actually written and how somewhat cohesive it was, somewhat. But I ended up writing a lot like I was writing a short story because I was trying to put pieces back together. So I don't think that I had the idea of bringing it together as a book until I started looking at the length, the lack of construction that it had. And then I remembered, I wrote this paper on nonlinear narrative when I was in college. So let's just try to apply some of that. and it totally worked. And at two editors later, it turned into a book.
Yeah, and I probably should have lied, but I'm just really like the idea of writing a book in itself is always, and we cover comics on the show pretty much exclusively, but I've always been interested in kind of long form narrative, especially kind of biography and memoir and kind of that, and a lot of the comics we've covered have been that, so I'm always interested kind of the jump to that, because I feel like that is a big jump. Most people, like, I think anyone that's going to write a good one isn't going to sit down with the idea of doing it. So I think the idea how that goes from kind of the broad thoughts to the construction of a book is always interesting. But obviously, I think to set context, what is Heavy Metal Headbanging about?
It's crazy. I've never been asked this question. For as many times as I can write it down, I feel like I've only ever done it in writing. I guess now is as time as any.
As you do more interviews, that's all they're going to ask you. It's like the...
It's about me getting hit by a car on my way to see Judas Priest. I sustain a head injury, and this is kind of my way in writing this is my map back to the present day and trying to construct my life and how it ended up being the way that it was. And I didn't realize how much of that ended up being through publicity and PR work. So.
Was, obviously, like, I reading the book, I haven't been able to read it all yet. I've read as much as I could, and... I think that's kind of obviously, I think, like the tagline and the focus, the traumatic brain injury and the accident, but you kind of go through, you know, your life with PR, but then also other like touchstones in your life and everything like that. How was that taking kind of your thoughts and your journaling and finding kind of a narrative through line? Was that difficult, or as you kind of looked at all those pieces, was it pretty clear like what the through line was, and was it just then kind of sliding the pieces together to make kind of like a cohesive narrative for the book?
It kind of reminds me a little bit of, you know, those little plastic puzzles that we had as kids where you would slide the slats to try to make a cohesive picture. Like every single element is there, but you can't quite get to one side of the picture or get the picture totally together until you can figure out how to slide all the slats a certain way, or like a Rubik's cube. That's how it ended up being what it was. It's like, I knew that these certain milestones and elements were there, whether it be from dealing with the MVA case as it stood as a case, because I never had to deal with an attorney. I've never been a victim of something, which in turn, you know, sorry to spoil, but guess what? They didn't try to make me out to be a victim. They made it try to look like I was trying to commit suicide or something. They didn't have a leg to stand on in that regard, but it's me fighting against a system constantly. And that's a huge part of it. And it's a huge part of the anxiety that I grew up with, was always just fighting against a system. And I'm like, wow, is it just me, or is everybody against me, or am I for everything? Am I like the little, have you ever seen the movie Unico on the Island of Magic?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that's kind of how I felt, where I was like Unico, like I was a happy little kid, just trying to get along with everybody, trying to be the nice person, always giving up my toys, and then my toys would get stolen. My sisters were mean to me. I was always picked on. And I was just a nice kid, and I think that built this really strange anxiety in me. And the more that was taken from me, the more I was able to relate it to the case that was going on and how that's relative to the way that I look, because I look different because I felt ostracized. And it's just always it's like a proverbial double-edged sword, I guess, if that makes any sense at all. But that was a huge part of me sliding these pieces together as well. Just realizing the amount of anxiety that I had, the lack of self-esteem that I had, even though I was like still advocating to be friendly to everybody. And I think that ultimately winds up in how I adapted very well through entertainment. I grew up on television. I sit in front of the television for hours and hours and hours. I listen to music for hours and hours. I draw for hours. I write for hours. It was just always like I needed something to get outside of feeling so small. And I wouldn't say that I was delusional, but I could, because I really thought that Chucky was real. And I thought that the Jabberwocky lived in the woods. And I thought that there were Smurfs living under real mushrooms, so I didn't step on them. This is in the book too. I literally thought that my neighbors were Hawkeye Pierce and Laverne DeFazio, and they were married. I thought Mr. Belvedere lived across the street. I don't know. It was like this escapism that I tethered myself to so tightly, because it was the only sense of control and reality, because I was always being pushed out and picked on, I guess.
It's interesting how you say that controls reality when it's so fantastical in itself.
But I guess that's why, you know, working in entertainment kind of makes sense. Because you have the obvious elements of people being entertained, but it's just also the love of stories and the passion that people have to push them out. That sounded really bad. Don't be to produce them. They have this amazing ability to produce stories, and to be a part of that and to see the construction of it and appreciate that whole appreciate those steps, I guess, is what I'm looking for. It's just a nice escape. And I'm always looking to escape every single day.
Right. And I think I feel like I'm very much the same in the sense where, like, as a kid, my parents were all about, you know, very much so, like, if another kid did something wrong, they wouldn't yell at me, but they would, like, point it out and be like, don't you ever do that. Like, don't you act that way. And so it was like, well, I didn't do anything. And, like, so I was just, like, it's just ingrained in me to be, like, extremely nice. Like, if someone's in the grocery store, like, in an aisle, I won't even go down. I'm like, well, I don't want to bother them. Like, I don't want to make them feel like they have to move. And I don't know why. Maybe it's something like that where it led to me, like, being very invested in stuff as a kid. Like, I don't know how old I was. I was old enough where Buffy was on. I watched Buffy, like, and I was, like, obsessed with it. And then I got the idea that my grandparents could, or I don't know, I just thought they could be vampires. And we went to stay with them once, and I just couldn't get over the fact that maybe they are. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense, but maybe they are. Like, I could be wrong, but do I want to be wrong if they are? I don't know what they would do, but I couldn't sleep the whole time. I had, like, a nervous breakdown about the fact that, like, it could be. And then my dad's like, no more this for you at all. But at the same time, I was like, oh, I need this. Like, this is my life. But I don't know if there's something with that, like, where, I don't know, I don't want to say nice equates, like, kind of, but you find yourself just, like, invested in these things. And that's, I think that is what's great about entertainment. And, you know, we talk about comic books, and I see it with my kids, is like, I try and get them to be like, it's the biggest cliche in the world, but, like, if you read a book, like, it's an experience. And, like, that's what I love so much about it, is, like, you know, whether I you know, go to quote-unquote Narnia or something like that, a kid's book, but, like, you get that feeling that you did. Those are your friends and stuff like that. And, like, that's why I think creative people are so drawn to these kind of industries or avenues, is because, like, it's you become invested in it, and then at the same time it feels great to create it, or, you know, in the case of, you know, like, PR, help take people's ideas and share them with people who, you know, should be shared with those ideas, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And we all grew up on the East Coast, so we kind of have an understanding of how stodgy that upbringing is compared to living on the West Coast, for sure. Because everybody over here is very enlightened to say the least, and it's acceptable to kind of escape in that way. But on the East Coast, it's very rigorous. At least, you know, when I was growing up, it was like you did everything by the book. And if you did anything different, you were just hail Satan, you know?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've joked about it on the show before, because like I live in upstate New York, and like if you tell someone outside of the East Coast that you live in New York, they assume you live in New York City, or New York is all like New York City. But if you talk to anyone like on the East Coast, or especially in New York, they fucking hate New York City, and like it's like the most like conservative, like Republic, like it's like, you know, there's like signs all over the place like Hank Cuomo and like Trump for governor, and it is like this weird, like I don't know what it is, but yes, like it was growing up, and even like, I mean, a pretty open high school, but stuff like, but I was like a music kid, and it was like, you know, I played sports at the same time, but it was like this weird thing where it was always kind of like in the back of your head as a kid of like, do I fit in? What am I doing? Like, and that just obviously leads to a whole different stuff as you grow up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as you, you know, writing the book and kind of exploring the timeline and the kind of concrete things that happened, like these are, you know, you're talking about, you know, the accidents or your recovery or, you know, your time and work and stuff. We're exploring those things, kind of avenues to kind of explaining, but, you know, reconciling your past or reconciling feelings, was like the ability to kind of put down to paper the things that happened and then explore almost like narratively. Was that kind of like a therapeutic in the sense kind of exploring your larger life as a whole?
I would say not as much as the larger scope of my life, but the direction that I took to ground myself at where I was, because dealing with disassociation, and that's the one thing that I had to deal with. I didn't recognize my own face. I was working in real time to where I was doing things on autopilot that I knew that I had to do to survive, but how I got to that point legitimately made zero sense. I was just like, okay, I know that I'm, you know, in my mid-30s, I know I have a job, I know I have bills to pay. I was very confused and angry as to why it happened, because I was agile in crossing the street. I was in a crosswalk. I had a destination, and I didn't get to see Judas Priest. And I was so hell-bent on seeing Judas Priest that when they put me in the ambulance, I said, I'll go. You know, I was so disoriented. I was like, I'll go to the hospital, but the minute I get there, I'm taking a lift to see Judas Priest. I was really that disconnected. And it wasn't until about, you know, and having to go through therapy and being on that autopilot because everybody's telling me this is what you have to do versus I know what I have to do to survive. When I started putting those narratives together just to collect the memories, I was like, oh yeah, because it works. I wrote everything mostly in real time as I was going through therapy to deal with my feelings of disassociating. And that's what would start moving this narrative in and out. It weaves in and out of consciousness, basically. Because part of it is in real time where I'm dealing with the hospital, or I'm dealing with the legal side, or I'm dealing with going to therapy, or I'm dealing with losing my job. You know, it's all these things across the board, but I'm able to cherry pick memories to connect that relativity. Okay, I felt this way at a certain time before. Let me explore that. And that's how disassociated people tend to come back to terms with grounding themselves in the now, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Was it difficult, I guess, then, at least for you, as I think I've talked about on the show, and obviously, like, this is, I work with people with traumatic brain injuries. This is my job. I have for about 4 years now, and like one of the biggest things is that I, you know, advocate for is, you know, journaling, whether it be to kind of, you know, timeline things or to work through stuff. It's also because, you know, it's such an individualized, like, disability that everyone's different. So it kind of helps to, you know, coordinate yourself, ground yourself in kind of what you need and what you need to work on. How was that, not only then kind of, you know, doing that, but was there any further difficulty, like, writing the book? Was there any way you kind of had to, like, change how you might have done something before? If you, you know, like you said, you were a writer before, you went to school for that. Was it any different, like, post-injury on how you actually, like, tackled writing the book? That had that changed at all? And had you, like, worked on kind of different coping strategies for actually, like, being a writer, kind of the like, nitty-gritty of actually writing a book?
I did journal for a very long time, but I had stopped. When I started really getting heavy into in-house PR instead of freelancing, I didn't have any time to write except for writing press releases and writing pitches. So that's where all my energy was put. When it came to the, you know, whether that was an element that was constructive, I guess so to some degree. But with the other therapies, the other setbacks that I had, I couldn't look at a computer screen for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stay awake for a very long time. My eyes were misaligned, so I couldn't actually look upward for a very long time. I couldn't travel. I couldn't leave my house. I could barely, like, grind coffee beans in the morning. Like, by the time I got to go out the front door on a normal day, it would be like 15, 30 minutes tops. It took me 2 hours. So the therapies I had to go to, and also, like, the audio side of it was the biggest thing. So they say anything, and you know this, like, any problem that you have prior to a brain injury, it intensifies with that brain injury. So having misophonia, like, I'm really weird about pitches and noise, like squealing sounds and screeching, and so that was a real agitator of mine. So I just couldn't handle it. Also, I couldn't hear because I had a large amount of blood congealed in one of my ears where the clot was. So it was like a whirring. It was like having a conch shell to your head. Add that to being on high alert, because after you get hit by a car, your body is prepared for impact for several weeks after the accident. So you're chronically fatigued. Your muscles are very loose, so you don't have much energy. And so when I would cross the street, I'd have to make sure there was another pedestrian there. Going to the grocery store was terrifying, because walking down an aisle and coming out the other end and seeing a shopping cart, or as we call them, buggies, I will say that. You know, and something's coming at you in your peripheral, you just have a panic attack and freak out. So it was like the only place that I felt safe was in a little catacomb in the dark for I don't know how long. I think it actually took me over a year and a half to, I would say, recover 90-95% just from all of that, all of it. I was in speech therapy. I was in occupational therapy. I was in physical therapy. I was in psychological therapy. They put me on Zoloft because I would have chronic mood swings from wherever my head was hit. I would have these chronic outbursts, which I still have, but I'm not on the Zoloft. It's fine. So yeah, all of those components stacking on each other, writing was the only release that I would have, so I would kind of make my way back to it in order to alleviate some of that stress. But it was minimal because, like I said, I couldn't I couldn't function that well for a very long time.
Right. It's, I think one of the themes throughout the book and kind of in the like press for the book and again, it's kind of perforated throughout the book and it mirrors your career, the idea of like, you know, PR and kind of image and like how you perceive things and the idea of PR and like presenting, you know, your best foot forward and all that. But one of the most interesting things about kind of the TBI and something that generally always advocating for and the kind of difficulty of that is that it's like an invisible illness. It's something that is completely, I guess, internal and, but, you know, to anyone like family, friends, or you're out in public, like, you know, again, the light sensitivity or the noise or again, the mood swings and stuff like that. Like it just appears at, like, to someone who doesn't understand what's going on, like this weird thing. How do you reconcile that then now kind of and working in PR and kind of doing that? Has a, I don't know, like, I don't want to say like, how's it going, but like, how is there any, I don't know, is the irony kind of there in the sense of like what you've done and that in itself, and then kind of working with your clients and the understanding of what's going on with you, is like, how does all that come together for you? I guess, even if it's a question, I don't know how to like,
no,
like put that all together.
I think I pick up what you're putting down. It makes you more empathetic. I have never, you know, strongly advocated for anything. If anything, I really want them to put a light where I was hit, because there should have been one. Or a stop sign or something. So that would be my number one advocacy. But people with mental illness, and it's definitely a disability like the one that I have, it's not apparent. Once those black eyes go away and it's not visible on the outside, I really started to empathize with people with chronic mental illness and to not even put myself on that caliber. I just said, I'm going crazy and there's nothing I can do about it. And everybody else thinks I'm crazy and that's it. And that's just it. That's all I'm going to get. And even, you know, the therapists were like, it'll get better. It'll get better. And everybody, you know, I hear people with depression say that, and how their friends say it and how their parents say it. And the nice thing about working with clients, they're so transparent with me about what they're going through and why they're writing things. And that's why I choose to work with people who have a story to tell that has a very strong backstory. It's like, it is their mission to get across so much of the Mishigas that they're having to deal with that other people don't understand. And it's, a lot of it is emotional turmoil. Some of it's mental illness. I worked with one client who had chronic diabetes, and he wrote about that in a very constructive way. And it made me switch my idea on how to function as a publicist more than anything, because, forgive me if I go off the rails, most publicists, I have to be honest, don't give a damn about their clients. And maybe that should be off the record, but I honestly feel like it's the truth. Like, I don't think that people who take these positions are thinking about the betterment of the client or what the client is representing or what the client has to give in terms of creativity. They're just looking to slap on that black dress, get on the red carpet, and see who their next, you know, client is going to be, if they'll pay them more, or et cetera, et cetera, or find their next husband or wife, you know? And that's the sad truth, because that's entertainment in a nutshell. And I have the great privilege of being compassionate, I guess, because of this. And not to say that I wasn't before, but I'm even more so now. But that also goes into understanding the ebbs and flows and the cogs of the entertainment system in general.
Yeah, and I would imagine that's, like, I don't think that's like, I don't know, like damning or anything like that. Like, I think there's obviously, like, in any career, in a sense, like, even, you know, with comics or something like that, like, obviously there's writers who, you know, take gigs because it's a gig, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then there's obviously, like, you know, writers who take take a project because, like, you know, they, you know, obsessed with Spider-Man with as a kid or something like that. Or, you know, in my field where, like, it's super easy to kind of get attached to your clients, but there's also, I know there's also, like, case managers who don't get it. Like, it's a job, it's a paycheck, what you get is fine. But it's also, like, kind of what you want out of, you know, your work, but also what you want other people having that kind of empathy, and also what you want people to succeed and other people who aren't you to do well. Something we haven't really talked about, and as we have people on who kind of do other roles in comics, if someone, we have someone on who's like an editor or color or something like that, it kind of, that discussion and kind of broaden people's idea of what goes on in the industry, like maybe in comics specifically, but kind of in general, like what, I don't think people really know, like, you know, PR, I think people have the idea of like what they see, like, you know, some made up role in a movie. Like, I don't think that's actually like what PR is like in kind of like the broadest sense. Like what is PR to you, and like what does it do, I guess?
What do you do?
It's funny, my parents have asked me that for so long, and even when I explain it, they're like, I don't get it. PR is the representation of a person, or in my case, a comic book, or previously a film, or an album, and giving direct publicity to that person through a vast network of contacts that I have who do journalism. That's the basic of it. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's more to that. But there actually is, because there's a lot more work that needs to be done than people realize. It's not just the clients that you garner. It's the context that you have. It's your way to do research and do a lot of research. And, you know, a lot of people think, you know, I have access to the EIC, or I have access to the CEO, so I'm going to go right to them and they're going to listen to me. No. You need to work on a totem, and you need to work from the bottom all the way up. And it takes a very long time. And as you learn the agility, and as you learn, not only is that benefiting you, but it's benefiting them to a certain degree. And having that rapport and being kind is the number one thing in all of it. That if you're an asshole, you're not gonna get anywhere. Unless you're Kanye West, then that's fine. We digress. But I guess what it comes down to is that everybody, you know, there's people that expect to be famous tomorrow, and that doesn't happen. It doesn't work that way. So it's my job to kind of walk them through what their position is, what their competitors are, and give them the resources through the resources I have to connect them so they can basically be self-sustaining on their careers through the work that they've done. That sounded so dictionary.
Well, I mean, speaking specifically from, again, like, we've been familiar with Melissa in kind of the podcast sense of her kind of helping us get people on the show and her coming to us with that. And so obviously the conversation has come up when we're talking to these people about Melissa. And I think the general sense, like, especially with comics, and another question following up later, but like everyone is like, oh, you know, she's on top of setting these type of things up, because again, it's hard when you're especially in comics, like you still have to like make the books, do all that stuff, and then you're expected to do like all these other things. But I think in general too, it's like having, when a lot of these projects, whether it be music or comics or anything like that, like a lot of times it's like a very individual and like alone feeling of you're making these things and then you have to get them out somewhere. And at least like to have someone on your side and kind of walk you through that and help you, I think is a big thing. And especially in comics where, you know, that's not something I think a lot of creators think about in general. Like I don't think it crosses a lot of their mind that it's available or to have that or how beneficial that is. And for an industry where it is, again, even when you have books coming out from Marvel and DC and you're getting no help, like they just expect you to like, oh, set up these interviews, go on Twitter and promote your own thing. Like, it's a struggle. So like people who kind of have these individual and unique stories to tell, to kind of wade into that water, I think, you know, you've done amazing work. And a lot of the interviews we've had have been with creators who have these really awesome stories to tell, and like, to help get those out to people, I think, in general, is kind of what you help do, which is amazing, I think.
Thank you. No, I do it because I love doing it. There are times that I wish I could stop doing it, and not in the sense that I want to stop PR altogether, in the sense that I wish that I didn't have to work 7 days a week. But it's small parts of my day. Like, I have the grand fortune of basically picking up and going to Target, because that's the only place I go anymore. I'll pick up and go to Target, and then if something happens, it's on my phone. Or if I forget to send something out, I can send it out from my phone. If I need to check a spreadsheet, because I do track everything with spreadsheets and I set alerts, I'm very organized in that regard. It's all right there. So I have the nicest work-life balance. Because one, I have everything with me at all times, but at the same time, it could work against me because I'm like, oh, I'm working 7 days a week now. But then I look at the larger scope of everything and I'm like, I'm working on everybody else's time. And that's good because I'm doing good for other people, if that makes sense. It's kind of like my therapist being on call, you know? Which she is, it's great. I'm not going to argue that. I'll just like send her like a crazy gift at like 9 o'clock at night. Tim gets them too. Don't let him fool you.
They're wonderful.
Right. And I mean, like, again, for, oh, I don't, it's, I say, gift, but I don't think that's, but like for these, no, it, I think the guy who made it said, I don't, all right. But for your clients too, like obviously for you, again, they're clients, and you know, they may be friends, you may have those relationships, but too, like for almost all of them, like this is kind of their dream, and like you said, like to have, again, you're kind of working on their time in that sense, like you know, it's something I struggle with a lot as a case manager, like. Everyone's problem is an emergency, whether it's not really an emergency or not, but like, because it's, you know, it is like you're helping them kind of bring their dream to fruition. Like, it feels like that. So again, to kind of have that, you know, flexibility and ability to kind of answer that call at times is, I think, huge. And I don't like, that's what I work at this point, 6 days a week. And I see those people, like, I don't know, those people who say like they could never not work. That's fucking nuts. Like, if you could tell me today that I didn't have to work ever again, it would be fucking awesome. I don't know these people who think they would, like, need a job. Like, people, like, I have my mother-in-law who's like, oh, I don't know about retire. I'm like, the second I'm never going to be able to retire because fucking boomers. But, like, I would love, like, that's insane. If you can't find a way to, fill your time, you're a crazy person. That's a crazy person.
Yeah. I think I would get really depressed if I didn't have my work. It's honestly like the best drug I could ever get to any degree, because maybe it's just that whole aspect of knowing that I'm like on a solo mission to bring people's stories alive and put them in the hands of other people. And it's, you know, it's usually for people that don't have a publisher. Or it is for people who have publishers that they're overlooked at. And it's like, wow, they worked, you know, sometimes it takes 10 years to write a comic book. Sometimes they'll be writing a comic book for 20 years and nobody will see it. And the fact that I get to be that conduit, you know, it's like, wow, you know, I hear your story. I see what you're saying. I really believe in you. And that's why I have like a vetting process. Like, I don't charge for consults because I'm like, I just want to make sure you're not an asshole. And I tell everybody that I have a consult. It's like, I just need to make sure that we can jive, because if I'm going to work with you, and I say work with you, not for you, because I don't work for anybody. I work with everybody. Oh, rainbows. You know, I mean, honestly, like, I would lose a shit if I didn't have my job. Because to me, like, I'm a homebody. I'm home, I don't know, like 90% of the time. And sometimes I crack and I take a road trip somewhere. Like yesterday I drove to Snoqualmie so I could see the Twin Peaks Diner and the waterfalls. But I did it by myself. So I'm always like, this is my social, it's not even so much my job as it is like my social well-being and feeling like I'm connected, because that's what the brain injury really did to me. It like totally damaged my ability to be in public. I mean, even doing conventions are a little difficult still.
I can imagine. I mean, they're, again, they're difficult in general, but like the amount of kind of various stimuli in a large setting like that would be difficult. You talk about it in the book, and you talked about kind of the range of PR you've done and kind of now doing comic PR. What have you seen kind of the difference in the worlds of that, and kind of what have you noticed with comics, I guess, in doing PR and kind of the different mediums that you've worked in?
It's variations of passion and also trust. In music, you know, there would be times where you can't get a band to a studio because they're all drunk. Or you work in film and you realize you're working with a director that was just hired by a production company and he's just there because the production company told him to be. It's not that he was invested in the film that he made. And with comics, it is a very, it's a deliberate work of art. And I say heart, not art, which it is both. They're extractable. but like, I go back to the fact that I said, you know, they spend 20 years, 10 years, you know, they sit on these ideas for such a long time. I talked to a client a couple months ago and he said, I don't ever want this to be a movie. I just want it to be a comic book. And I'm like, okay, bro, I got your number. And it's also the amount of respect that you have for your project and the time you're investing in it, to the fact that it's not even conscious to you. You're like looking back and you're saying, holy hell, I've just been doing this for how many years? I didn't realize how much I cared about this. Okay, so what do I do next? What are my next steps? And that's where I come in, basically. And then, like, with working in music, it is like you get a cutoff point. I think by the time you're 35, you're not allowed in a showroom anymore, or like at a concert, because I remember it was probably 2012. I was in Austin and I was doing PR for a band, and I was the oldest person. And I wasn't even, like I said, I was in my early 30s. I was the oldest person next to the stage. And I was like, oh God, I need to get the hell out of here. And then working in film, like, I've met a lot of great people, like celebrities. And I realized the thing is, the more tenured they are, the longer they've been in the industry, the more gracious they are. Like I met Tab Hunter before he died. And he was the most gallant, lovely human being. I can't even express to you like how professional he was in that regard. And then I would deal with, you know, first or second film producers or directors, and they'd be like, I want this, I want now. Like, where's my cup of beer? You know, stuff like that. So, if you can actually extract those differences by way, but I always had a penchant for nerds, and you can cut this down however you want to. But like I said, it just goes into that time and passion that they're willing to put in, and the respect that they have for the work as it stands, and not really thinking about the trajectory of, is this going to be a film or not? They just care about it being a concentrated comic and getting the right eyes on it.
You know, I'm just really surprised that comics need PR, because comics sell themselves, right? Like, your job is easy, right?
Are you joking? You're joking. Well, that being said, it's the density of everything too. It's because it's a saturated market. There are a lot of avenues. A lot of the companies are being bought out by holding companies, including a lot of journalism is being bought out by holding companies too. So it is changing the whole dynamic, and also the internet, the oversaturation with the protocol being 0.2 seconds, you know, per refresh or something like that. I think if anything, there's more of a need for my job in comics than ever. Thanks, Tim. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome.
Making me justify my actions.
It does seem like, as someone, and I mean, Tim can attest to this too, like, who has worked for sites. I mean, obviously, I think the podcast is different because it's kind of a very specific thing. Like, you kind of have to be listening, like, searching out a podcast. But, like, for Multiversity, I specifically do interviews. And, like, I see, like, because I mean, I can only see mine and I can see stuff, but I see, like, the hits on there and then, like, kind of what actually works on these websites, and none of it is shit that like would promote a book. It's all like these dumb fucking articles about, like, I shouldn't say that because I've already said, but like like the TV shows are like these listicles and stuff. And like, again, I am like generally kind of proud of a lot of the written interviews I did. Like, I just did one with Cy Spurrier, and it was like this long interview and like really thoughtful, and like I was like super excited about this book, and I'm like, this is great. And like, nobody cared. Like, nobody reads that stuff. And it's like, what do you do? Like, that's what you would do to promote a book. Like, you know, I did an interview about the book. Go read it, and you'll read the interview, and then you'll be interested about the book. But like, it's such a weird market. I do not envy being a creator, and I do not envy being a like PR person who has to like promote comics in this market where it seems like, it's kind of like hit or miss, or just like roll a dice on like how you get those things into people's hands.
Yeah. And it's really contingent on what their goals are. If they just want people to read their comic, and which in case falls in line with Kickstarter campaigns a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But I've also talked to people that, you know, this wasn't working as a screenplay, so I turned it into a comic, and maybe it'll get turned into a movie from being a comic. There's other people that, you know.
Oh, you work with Mark Millar?
And sometimes it happens accidentally. I'm still kind of curious, like, what the trajectory is. Other people talk about sales a lot. And they, you know, I've had companies ask me about metrics. And then I said to someone recently, Tim, it actually might have been you. A company had asked me about all the metrics of their press using what are those links called? UTM, using a UTM, so they can see how many clicks that they get and versus, and they can balance the metrics between pledges and clicks and all that crap. And I'm like, this is way beyond what I do. Like, when I started PR, and also how that translates to sales and shops as well. When I started PR, it was, you go into a room, you go around and talk to people, you make those connections, you give your phone number or your email later on, but usually your phone number. And there was no texting. It's like you had a landline. Actually, I think I had a Nokia candy bar phone when this all went down. And you would go home, and I had like these notepads, these teeny tiny notepads, and I would write down what the person looked like, what they did, and I had their phone number. And I also wrote down who they talked to and who they knew. So that way I could kind of piece together my next steps for either pitching something or getting a connection for something else. It was so dirty back then, and I kind of liked it. I kind of liked it dirty because you're always a fly on the wall. And with the representation that you have to have as a publicist now, especially on the internet, like, you have to have some sort of something, whether it be the way your press releases are drafted or the dumb things you say on Twitter, Keanu Reeves. don't even get me started on that tweet. I haven't checked the impressions on that one lately, but it got me in trouble. for just having an opinion. And that's the thing that you do in companies when you're working in a system. When you are a publicist in-house, you don't have that luxury of standing out. You are simply just a conduit, and you are representing the company in the catalog, and you don't have a face or a name. Well, you have a name, but it's digital. And in this situation, like, it's not like you can walk up to people face-to-face anymore, especially because of the pandemic. Or there's no events where you can go and work a room. You can just do all your research online and reach out to people individually and hope that you make those connections. So it's very, very, very different than the way it used to be, of course. If that gives you any insight, you can cut that too, if you want to.
Oh. I'm not good enough to cut it. I think it's all good. I was going to ask a question about, I was like, has it permeated TikTok? Have you had to learn TikTok? And then I just Googled comic book TikTok, and comicbook.com has a TikTok. And they do it, and it looks real cringy. But it hasn't seemed to have permeated that yet.
I've been asked the question a lot, are there comic book influencers? And I asked that question on Twitter a lot. And I'm like, are there? I have no clue. And I'm like, that doesn't really seem to make sense considering the demographic. And I just did a poll of, you know, print versus digital. Lo and behold, print. But what would a 20-year-old say if they learn from their parents who go and buy print comics? They're going to want print comics. So I think that comics is a very concentrated medium to where it is about print. Yeah, you can read it digitally, but it doesn't have the same... you're not gonna synthesize it the same way. And like I said, it's apples and oranges. Like, when I started reading comics, like, I was buying the Simpsons comics at the grocery store because we didn't have a comic shop where I grew up. And then I got really into Robert Crumb, and my dad told me, I got in so much trouble for buying Fritz the Cat on DVD on eBay when eBay first happened with my dad's credit card. And this is before debit cards too. So I bought it with my dad's credit card, and it comes in the mail. It's for him. He opens it up. He sees it, and he's like, he sits me down. He puts it on my bed. He puts a stick note on it. He said, "We need to talk." And I'm like, oh no. Cause this, you know, you've seen Fritz the Cat.
Yes.
Yes.
So
Wait, how old were you?
I was 17 when I bought it.
I feel like that's an okay... Yeah, I think it's an okay to watch it, but I don't know if it's an okay...
I don't know if, like, well, I never saw it.
There was no streaming service. We didn't have a video store that carried it. So I was like, oh, this thing, eBay. Oh, I can buy this here. This is so cool. You're like, this was like the time of interactive CD-ROMs, you know? So I bought it on CD. My dad brings me out to the kitchen. He has this conversation with me. This is like the highlight of my entire comics conversation with my father. And he says to me, "I took your cousins to the drive." My cousins are like 20 years older than me, 15 years older. He said, we took your cousins to the drive-in, and they thought it was a double feature with Felix the Cat. So you take them to this double feature. They think it's Felix the Cat. And he opens up, and it's Fritz the Cat. And he goes, "Hi, all you motherfuckers." And my dad was like, "You have two choices. You can sit down and watch this DVD with me, or you can throw it away."
Oh. Did you watch it with him?
No. I can tell you a worse story than that about my mom allegedly vacuuming up a plastic bag under my bed, but I won't go into that. You can cut that. somebody bought me a Gagius.
My grandma loved horror movies, and she was like one of the only ones in my family outside of my dad who did. So, like, I would watch horror movies with her. And then one time, I probably was in, like, ninth grade, maybe. I watched Fear with her. And that was, like, one of the most uncomfortable experiences of my life. when they're like on the roller coaster.
Oh, I was gonna say the roller coaster scene.
Yeah, and it's like you can't get. I was like, I want to get up and like go grab a drink or something, but I'm like, I can't get up because then like it's clear that like I'm comfortable. So like, it's probably less conspicuous if I just sit here and watch, like Mark Wahlberg finger blast someone with my grandma.
But like, it's like watching Tales from the Crypt with your family too. Like back then, I don't know, nudity was so prominent in like the 80s and 90s in horror, and it makes me so sad that horror movies are lame now, and you know, there's no nudity. And I remember, so have you seen Black Roses? It was the guy who did Terminator 2, the director, or was it Terminator 3? I don't remember. But
choose Black... James Cameron, right?
No, I don't remember. Was it? I think he did Terminator.
Yeah, I think 2 is, and 3 is someone else.
Yeah, his name was John Fasano. So he did all these horror movies, these hair metal horror movies, and his daughter did a music festival with me, like back in Portland a couple years back. So she takes me to his premiere of Black Roses, and he actually says that he put an extra topless scene, like a minute and a half, because the production company said the movie wasn't long enough. But it was like a woman standing in front of the mirror, topless and salaciously touching herself. And I was like, all right, way to screw the system there.
Also, heavy metal horror movie sounds like you have the title for your next book.
Well, you know how I came up with the title for this book? It's a given. So I was sitting in a cantina in New Mexico, eating chips and drinking a margarita, and I was like, the publisher told me, which the original title was Third Everything, which is like, it's my third life, I give up. And he didn't like it. They just said, no, this doesn't work. And now I learned now, like with titles especially and SEO, pick a good title, pick something that's not common. And obviously, like, you know, that's a, I mean, it should make your life easier.
Don't pages and panels for a comic.
Hey, you guys come up right away, so shush. It was called Third Everything, and I'm sitting in this cantina, and I was thinking about Judas Priest, and I loved the movie Heavy Metal Parking Lot, which is like a 17-minute long movie that they showed on cable access. And I was like, oh my God, heavy metal headbang. And I was like, wait, that has to exist already. It has to exist. And it doesn't. Because they wanted me to put a subtitle on stuff. And I'm like, oh, this isn't going to work. So when I came up with that, I was like, I was kind of three sheets, but I'm like, it's perfect. It's perfect. And that's my story.
I'm surprised that that is like something I would think would exist. And that's
there's nothing, at least, you know, until somebody comes after me. But we did a very strong vetting process with that title. So, yeah, it doesn't exist at all. Crazy.
And, I mean, speaking of connections and, like, hard, what you said, heavy metal horror, I mean, you're speaking to two guys who interviewed the director of Slaughterhouse Rock. So you're right.
You're right.
You're right in the right place.
I have such a penchant for horror, like anything horror, as long as it stays like before like 1994, maybe. Scream's okay, but I won't even give it that. Freddy versus Jason, iffy. But I think Brain Scan is in my top five of all time, bar none. Love that movie.
Yeah, we've talked about like the. I like a lot of horror now, but it's like a lot of horror that's kind of like kind of the new wave is horror based on kind of dread and atmosphere. But I've been listening to a podcast kind of on the Blank Check, and they're doing John Carpenter's filmography, and like there's something to be said about just like 80s, whatever that feeling and trope is, like, it's so fucking good. But
Phantasm, and
oh, Phantasm's so good.
Phantasm is so, and the soundtrack on vinyl, oh, so good, so good. The one I'm thinking of, like now it's approaching Christmas, Jack Frost. That's a good one. Talk about a terrible scene. Oh no. And
talking about the scary Michael Keaton one.
No, the is it Michael Keaton? No,
there's two Jack Frost movies.
Yeah, there's one Michael Keaton where he's like a shitty dad in like a shitty jazz band, and he's like in a car accident and dies, and he like soul inhabits a snowman so he can like reconcile with his son.
Oh, that sounds it's like Ghost Dad.
Yeah, but Michael Keaton hasn't raped anybody, so that's better.
That's better.
Oh, burn.
Which sucks, because I fucking loved Ghost Dad as a kid. I was like, oh, man, he's a dad and he's a ghost. But he's not really dead, right? I think. Yeah. I was so devastated.
It's like,
how dare you ruin Ghost Dad for me?
How dare you ruin Ghost Dad? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you ruin all those other people's lives, but specifically me, I cannot watch Ghost Dad now. Kids.
I just can't think of Jell-O pudding pops the same way.
It's fucking selfish.
Fucking selfish.
You ruined a whole generation of children in an inadvertent way, you know, but thank God, I think. But
for you, like we talked about it kind of in the beginning, being on this other side now and kind of being kind of in the creative realm and having to deal with your own PR and publishers and all that. What has that experience brought to you kind of now to your like doing PR for people? Like what is the biggest kind of takeaway you've had kind of being on the other side that now you're bringing to kind of your like everyday job?
It's, I feel like it's doing research in ways. Because there are things that I'm dealing with on this side now that I realize I can do better on the PR front. Like the tip sheets are something I never thought of. But also the execution in which publicists usually work is that they don't follow up on anything. So it seems to be a pretty consistent struggle, but also asking people for blurbs. It's terrifying, and that's something I never had to do. I did it for a little bit when I was working with people, and then I said, you know what, your word's better than mine. And I'm a third party, so it's easier for them to say no to you. So being confronted with having to ask for blurbs is a scary thing, because I'm reaching into like my little bag of tricks, but knowing this isn't gonna really be as target marketed in comics as it is in other parts of entertainment, as it is in other parts of dealing with head trauma and dealing with anxiety and dealing with being ostracized by the police department and you know, the way I look and all this other stuff with being tattooed and everything. It's very different. And that is the absolute most scary thing to me. On top of asking people to coordinate book signings and worried if my books are gonna get there. And being the center of attention is not my forte. Like if you have me on the phone, that's fine. But the minute I step into a crowd, I just shut down and fade into a wall because I'm so used to doing that. But I think taking those tools as I'm learning and having that my own experience to kind of, I don't know, remove myself as a publicist, but think like a publicist, but be a client. Also being a client's a big thing. Like I have a publicist, that's weird. And I'm like, what are you doing? What's going on? And they don't, like I said, they don't have tracking sheets like I do, keeping up on everything. So it's being kept in the dark a lot of the time. But I think that was the number one thing that I saw throughout working in PR is that a lot of publicists keep their clients in the dark. And I never do. And that's not me being an advocate for myself. That's just me being a decent human. Because if somebody is paying for a service, I think that they should see outcome to some degree. Or they should see a process to some degree.
And I one of the like biggest things I've learned in like my regular job is along that lines is like a lot of times like people sometimes like updating that there's no update is like beneficial to people. Like letting people know you're working on something, whether like something has moved, is still good because like just because like a lot of times that's something like I'll overlook, like I'll the people working on me, I'll tell like you don't want to tell somebody like, you know, I put a call in and I'm waiting to hear back, because like that's not an update, but that is like an update to someone who is waiting on that info. So like just letting them know like, hey, I put the call in, I'm waiting, and then I'll let you update again. And if say like, oh, I still haven't, like I made another call, like just because nothing is physically happened, you've done something. And it's just like reassuring to let people know that like shit's being done.
Right. And it's the same thing with working with attorneys too, because working with attorneys, I realize that they don't give you updates and I would constantly have to harangue them. Like, can you just let me know, like, I don't know, once every 2 weeks what's going on, instead of turning the light off on me for like a month and a half or 2 months? Or because that, you know, when you put your measure of success into somebody else's hands and you're not giving them any insight as to what is moving, that is a cause for anxiety for sure. Because you're like, what's going on? What's going wrong? Because they say no news is good news. I call BS on that. Just be real. And I do think that having this experience like is really great research for me. Also inundating people with queries. As far as like scheduling interviews, like once a week is actually too much, even as they're getting closer to releases. So spacing things out, even 2 weeks is sometimes too much because, you know, they have jobs and they have lives and they have kids. And I didn't realize how much pressure I might have been putting on my clients to move the needle on their projects as I was moving along. Because for me, scheduling press for you know, myself with this book, I'm like, so you're telling me I have to go and do this thing that I do all day, every day for other people and a multitude of projects at a given time. Just blow my head off. Are you kidding me? Like, I gotta switch gears all of a sudden. But I think what it comes down to is if you're passionate about it. Yeah, in advocacy, if you don't care about your work, then you're not going to drop things to take care of that project and being mindful of it, I guess. Sorry.
I have two questions I kind of noted down that I want to ask before Tim's award-winning last question. I think one of the, like, a black and white one is, like, how did... You kind of talked about in the beginning that the book is being published and it's coming out on Oil on Water, which is like this is the first book they're putting out kind of under the like, because this is, what's that? It's through, I'm blanking now. I had it written down.
Head Press.
Yes. And it's kind of their like memoir line, biography, true story line. How did that kind of come about? Again, kind of getting a book published is, as you know, like difficult on its own, but kind of having that, is there any kind of more nervousness on your part of being kind of the first one on the line?
Not really. Because I've seen, you know, going to writing school and dealing with books all day, every day, it's really, it's chalked up to the audience and the way that the book is taken care of in press and marketing that will translate to its success. I didn't do much pitching for this book at all. I didn't even make a concentrated list of publishers that I wanted. I just did some research on, you know, it's unsolicited or solicited. They're taking solicitations, basically. Like, they'll take unsolicited manuscripts or whatever. So I was open to that idea, but I would also look at their catalog. But the cool thing about Head Press is that it was absolutely nothing relative except for the nuances in the book, being it was about, you know, there's parts that are very, very heavily music driven, very heavily entertainment driven, different things like that. And when I found Head Press, I was like, haha, hit my head, haha. And then I saw that they did all this amazing pulp stuff and horror stuff. And then they did the Graybow book. I was like, well, Gay Bikers on Acid. And I was like, yes, I do not care. I'm going to pitch this. And I was in Florida when I got the email and they said, yeah, we want to publish it. We don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to do it. And that's how Oil on Water Press got started. They were like, yeah, we're just going to do this imprint, which is like a really huge honor to think that somebody believed in this book so much that it gets its own little special niche in the world, I guess. But it's also, it's not a book that Simon & Schuster would publish, or Penguin, or whoever the hell else there is out there that doesn't give a damn about broken memoirs, you know? I'm going to be modest in the sense that I know that I am just another book on the shelf, but it's going to take effort on my end and the publisher's end and the audience's end to deem it worthy. So, and if it's shitty, then my life is shitty because it's a memoir and I'm willing to accept that. It's like, yeah, sure. Why not? Just as long as you don't, you know, take my comics family away from me, I'm fine.
They put out Leatherface versus Tricky Dick. I didn't know that was.
Yep, that's one of their biggest books.
That looks fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Oh god, I'm gonna buy more. God damn it! I gotta get off this.
I haven't heard any of the other titles that are being put on Oil and Water yet. All I know that this is the first one. And they're going to be, I think they're going to be doing a soft launch in December, as they said. And it was supposed to come out in hardback, but I'm only seeing it in paperback. And I haven't gotten the final galley for it yet. I'm just getting random emails here and there about the printing process.
I wonder, is it one they're going to do both? Like a hard cover and a paperback print?
Thinking, because it is UK layman's terms, so I'm thinking, are they doing a soft publication in December, or they're doing a digital in December, and then they're doing a hardback? Because they're doing two distributions. One is in the UK, and they're doing the US release in March, at least to my understanding, because I never spoke with them on the phone. It's all been through email. But they've been really awesome at like being communicative, so I'm very grateful for that.
Hardcover all the way. Don't get that soft cover stuff. Get out of here. And my last question again before you endure Tim's question, kind of twofold. I think with a story like this, I'm interested, kind of obviously, what you hope people take away from it. But then also, I guess kind of, we've talked to people who've done, you know, memoir comics or anything like that, and kind of the idea of putting yourself out there and kind of, again, the stuff you kind of cover in here, I don't want to go into anything specific because, again, I think it's a really amazing story. But it's like some deep, I feel okay saying like kind of traumatic stuff in here. And kind of, again, your role in PR and kind of your general life of interacting with people, like, obviously, what do you hope people take away from it? But also kind of the idea of people reading this and then kind of working with you and having it all out there. Is that something you thought about when making it? Or is that kind of, again, you're pretty open and kind of conversive person in the beginning. So, like, is that something that you're already comfortable with?
I think that when people choose to work with me or when they become friends with me, they know that I can be cold at first, but then I open up. And when I open up, it's like you get the floodgate. And if you don't see something you like, then you can walk away. And I'm lucky. I still have friends from when I was 5 years old. So I think that speaks some volumes of my character, if people are going to judge my character. But the takeaway would be, you know, the Phoenix side of everything. Like, you can go through a bunch of Mishigas, right? And it's more or less, if you can withstand all of that and you can understand who you are deep down and accept the adversity of what any kind which people are willing to impose on you, and you stay altruistic to yourself and you stay compassionate to other people in that regard, then you're going to make it just fine. I mean, because it does get really, really dark. There, I mean, actually, I think it was labeled as misery literature in the UK, which was shocking.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, misery lit. And I was like, what is misery lit? I was like, is it? I didn't think it was that dark. I really didn't. But yeah, it is about coming out on the other side of all these other things, because not to say that I didn't have help. I got a lot of help, but it was mainly from the comics community, and it was their emails and DMs and tweets that really got me through, because I was mostly isolated through a lot of this. I didn't really have anybody come and take care of me, maybe my sisters for a week or two. And everybody there from like Dark Horse and Image and Oni, like, were coming to my house and bringing me food, and I had creators being really supportive and understanding of what was going on and handling the situation with such agility. But that came from being compassionate and kind before all of this happened. So I think, yeah, don't be an asshole. If you want to kick it with the whole original rule, it's like, yeah, don't be an asshole. You'll come out on the other side just fine. You'll get through it.
And speaking of assholes, Tim,
I want you to ask your question.
Melissa, gun to your head, if you had to write one episode of Two and a Half Men, what would happen?
God damn it, it was already written. The one where Charlie Sheen dies.
Did they kill him on that?
They killed him off. They didn't kill him off in any specific way, just in the season where they kicked him off after the whole tiger blood thing.
Yeah.
They showed them carrying the ashes, and they spilt them all over the floor. That's the only episode I remember. That is the only episode I remember. Oh, do you want me to delve further into that? Because I could talk about the ways I would like to see a character go on network television.
No. I guess they killed Roseanne too, right? She's dead on that.
Yeah, I think there were ashes in that too. But I hate to like be a girl for a minute, but I've been like doing some hardcore internet sleuthing on the next Sex and the City that's coming out next month. And I'm like, oh my God, did you kill off Mr. Big? And I went as far as going on IMDb to make sure that they didn't. And I think they're going to kill Steve off because he's only in one episode.
Is it all the same people?
It's all the original cast except for Kim Cattrall. Samantha.
Is she doing
Big Trouble
Maybe they
too?
Killed
Big
her
Trouble
off.
2? Is that a...
No, she's feuding with Sarah Jessica Parker.
She is. Very hard. And I don't know, maybe they killed her off because only from the images I've seen, they have a funeral scene somewhere, but I also saw a picture of Carrie kissing somebody else. So I'm like, how dare you kill Mr. Big? How dare you kill Mr. Like, I have been obsessing, and I wrote about it in the damn book. I refer to it a lot because it was really getting me through having that and the fucking Kardashians. Fuck the Kardashians. But a lot of this stuff that I had to reach back to kind of bring myself full circle, that was a lot of dirty work. I need to watch that shit again. I was gonna ask Tim how he would kill Charlie Sheen.
He likes Charlie Sheen. He's told me he likes him.
Probably, like, him and I are in a Corvette going down the highway at, like, 120. And... no, that just leads to us jumping off a ramp and going into the sunset. So, I don't know how I would kill him.
I think could be great if he
Thelma and Louise with Charlie.
No, he like his seatbelt. Like, he's not wearing a seatbelt, and you're going so fast that he just kind of slips out the back from like the wind penetrating him too hard, and he just flies off and like bounces on the freeway. That's not nice because this is all about getting hit by a car anyway. I'm still malicious. I stopped, you know, my biggest insult for a long time was die in a fire that I almost did, so I stopped saying that because it was my karma. I have a mean side, I just don't show it.
That's what you got. You're talking to two spicy mean boys, so.
or the meanest.
Stay tuned for our next podcast, Two Spicy Mean Boys.
Two spicy meatballs.
That's what I thought. I was like, we could do a Sopranos.
Two spicy meatballs.
But you have to spell it like it's almost balls. I don't know.
Yeah.
We're really getting into semantics.
But I will say, again, like, when you reached out, you could have been writing a book about poop, which would be interesting to us as well. But again, you're like Melissa, we've said, like, generally everyone we talk to, except for specific episodes where I've been struggling, should I delete them because they turn out to be horrible people? Melissa's like one of the nicest people that I've dealt with in comics and doing a lot, especially kind of on the more formal side, on the written interviews. I deal with a lot of like press and PR people and people at the companies, and Melissa's like genuinely one of the nicest people. And then when I had a chance to read a lot of the book, a big chunk of the book, it's not only is it great, and the story's great, and I have such an investment in it as well, and like I tried really hard to not just like go and ask all TBI questions because of my background, but like I'm so invested in TBI and advocating for it and really kind of getting out there the struggles of it and what really goes on. And it, again, it's something where, like, again, you were on your way to a Judas Priest concert and you hit by a car, and now you have a lifelong injury that you have to deal with. And like, again, it's something that can happen to anyone. No one's gonna be like, you're born with Down syndrome, you don't, like, you don't catch it, although I think people think that you could get a vaccine, I guess, and catch it or something. But like, TBI is something that could happen to anybody at any time, and it like upends your world, and something you have to continually cope with on a daily basis. And then for you to be able to kind of work through that, write a book and still do an amazing job as a PR is like, I don't know how you did it, and it's fucking awesome, and I'm super stoked for it to come out and other people to read it. So I guess thanks for talking to us. And again, if anyone wants to find out more about you, how can they do that?
They could find me on Twitter. It's at Melis Mazaris. And also my website, well, my business website, don'thidepr.com. But I'm mostly on Twitter, and everything else is set to private. For very good reasons, because I have to kind of separate myself a little bit. But I really want to thank you, you know, for chatting with me. And I really have to commend you for the work that you do, because if it wasn't for people like you that do the work that you do, I wouldn't be in the position that I am. So know that I am grateful, and I do see a lot of impact. You have bigger impact, if not the most impact, for people with traumatic brain injuries and people with just general disability in that regard for brain and advocacy. So I appreciate it.
I get paid to do it. So, no, I'm kidding.
Okay.
Well, it's nonprofit, so it is, because they don't. But no, I just, like, again, I absolutely love it. And we were talking about, I got to get on TikTok because the girl I work with currently, she's on TikTok. She's getting some money on there and being her TBI advocate. I don't know how she does. Like, I try and help her with it. I have no fucking idea.
It's all gobbledygook to me.
I can tell you something off record. My ex is on TikTok. He decided to document his journey as a nomad. And I knew he was trying to pick up girls using TikTok. So I went on TikTok and I made a video of him and I about how he ghosted our marriage. That one video got more views than all of his combined. And then I logged off of TikTok forever. I bowed out.
You just fucking leave.
I was just like, okay, dude.
Jesus.
Screw you. But I'm pretty proud of that.
That's insane.
Speaking of other jerks, for sure.
I'm gonna cut that. So I'm just gonna, it'll be out of no context. Speaking of other jerks, Tim, what do you want?
Well, speaking of jerks, we have been gone a while. I shut down Comics Pit because of some legal issues that had sprung up. I don't know if I can talk about that publicly yet. So yeah, just find me sitting in my bedroom, not writing about comics anymore. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madeira.
Yeah, catch him in between
when he's making a flip of a laundry.
I still need to go get my laundry.
Go down cellar and get your laundry.
And where are we? At @pages_panels. I'm Kyle Overkill on Twitter, I think. I don't know. I check that. And I occasionally do interviews over at multiversity.com. Like I said, I just did one with Cy Spurrier as someone who does interviews all the time. The dude wrote more like of an answer than I've gotten from like most people ever. It's actually really fucking great. So that's on there, but that's it. The more important thing is, can you pre-order it now? Do you know?
It is for pre-order on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. I will be utilizing the direct link once it is available.
So you can check for that. We'll have it in the show notes when it does. But again, more importantly, you can pick it up and go support it. Like I said, I can't give an official verdict because maybe it tanks at the end. I don't know. I doubt it. But I'm almost done, and I fucking loved it. Like again, I think it's a great story, and again, I enjoyed it. And again, I can't thank Melissa enough for being just one of the nicest people in comics, and thank her for sitting through our awful interviews.
They're my favorite interviews to listen to. You got me through 10 hours of driving.
That's insane. I don't want to listen to
it. I find it very entertaining.
Yes, I was going to say.
You host the best interviews.
You get 10 hours. You might have got like 10 minutes of Tim content.
It was in between that and like the Keith Morris audiobook, which he did not read, and they mispronounced Fugazi. They said Fugazi, and I was like, okay, you guys just lost all credit.
He didn't read his own book?
He didn't read his own book.
That's because Keith Morris doesn't know how to read.
Oh, burn.
When we were figuring out, we had been on hiatus. I got kids and they're doing all sports and all that garbage that's ruined my life. We will get back. And when we do, I will promise Tim we will do. We'll finally get to George Lopez. We got to figure out what's going on with Benny. I know. You should be. I don't know if the actual lady's dead. I think she's younger than George. I don't know. But we'll figure it out on the next episode, whatever.